Du lytter til Hestedølærerne. Podcasten for dig, der er dølæge eller veterinærsygeplejerske og arbejder med heste. Mit navn er Emma Thomsen. Jeg er dølæge og arbejder som konsulent for Børinger Ingelheim. I Hestedølærerne taler vi om tilstanden og sygdommen, der kan ramme heste, men vi tager også andre emner op, som er relevante for dig, der arbejder med hestesundhed. Denne podcast er lavet af Børinger Ingelheim, og med denne podcast ønsker vi at give noget tilbage til dig, der arbejder med hestesundhed. Vi ønsker at tage emner op, som er interessante og relevante for dig, og hvis du har forslag til emner, du gerne vil høre mere om, eller tips til en gæst, du gerne vil høre, så tøv ikke med at kontakte os. Mine kontaktoplysninger finder du i podcastens beskrivelse.
Welcome back to the podcast, Hästveterinärerna, Hästdyrlägarna, where we talk about interesting and relevant topics for you who are working as an equine veterinarian or veterinary nurse. And in this recent series, we are talking about infectious diseases in horses and how to treat and prevent them. In this episode, we are devoting the conversation to tetanus. This is a disease that, everyone knows of it, but perhaps everyone doesn't know that much about it and what it actually is and what we do about it. So I will start asking you, Louise, what is tetanus? What kind of disease is this?
Tetanus is a horrible disease, but it's also a 100% preventable disease, which is good because the word tetanus means that your muscle turns into complete spasm, and every muscles in your body gets locked in a spastic position. And for horses, that's absolutely devastating. And they're very, very sensitive to this toxin produced by the bacterium. The bacteria is a Clostridia tetani, it's called, and it's a bacteria that's found all over the world in soil. So it's a soil bacterium. There's nothing we can do about it. It is there. It's everywhere. It's outside in your garden. It's everywhere that you go out and have soil under your feet. So horses do live in an environment where they come in contact with soil and dirt and all these things on a routine basis. Where we, as humans, we live in a more protected environment where we don't get direct contact. So the bacteria on its own is not dangerous, but it's when the bacteria starts growing and dividing under certain circumstances, which is in anaerobic environments, for instance, deep in a wound that's anaerobic, then they start sporulating, dividing, and they produce a toxin in the process that's called tetanospasmin. And if that tetanospasmin gets in contact with the central nervous system, then it blocks some of our neurons, the inhibitory neurons. And that means that your muscles can't relax again. So it doesn't act locally. Like if you get a wound in your finger or if you get a wound in the hoof of a horse, it doesn't act locally right there, but it needs to be transported all the way up to the spinal cord. And there it turns into this irreversible block of these inhibitory neurons and you turn into a spastic paresis. It's very painful. And the horse, which is a flight animal, it's the worst of the worst. So so it's actually the toxin, the tetanospasmin, that's the problem here. Mm. So the best solution is to try and prevent the toxin doing its dirty job inside the body if it appears to be there, which is by vaccination, which is 100% preventable disease. You can get mild symptoms even if you're vaccinated, but you won't reach the stage where you need to be euthanized as a horse. So,
yeah, it sounds like a very horrible and devastating disease, really. And I'm guessing that the survival rate is not that optimistic or that it's a pretty deadly disease as well, right?
It is. So once you have that, it takes a while between depending on where you get your port of entry, which can be through wounds in the skin, but it can also be through your intestinal tract. If you're very unlucky, you can get ingestion of spores through the food. And then if you're very, very unlucky, it can sporulate inside your intestines. But most of the cases, it would probably be through a wound. But the problem with this disease is that it takes a while for this toxin to be transported all the way up to the spinal cord. So the time from you get your bacteria inside your body till you have clinical signs depend on the length of or the distance between the wound and the central nervous system. So if you get it from a wound on your distal limb, for instance, it takes a long time and up to maybe a month before you get your problem. So that's why you really have to make sure that you prevent any kind of growth of the Clostridia inside a wound right away, because otherwise you do risk having symptoms down the road. On the other hand, if you get a wound in your face and you get that, then you can get symptoms within a very short time, because the distance to your central nervous system there would be much shorter than from your distal limb.
Yeah.
So I hope that makes sense. So you're not safe from tetanus if you get a wound far from the CNS until you have maybe a month or so.
Yeah. So the wound itself could actually even be healed and completely normal again. And
exactly.
And before you develop symptoms.
That's what fools a lot of people when they have horses like this, because they keep searching for that point of entry to confirm. But in reality, this diagnosis is more a symptomatic diagnosis than anything else. We don't have any blood test that you can run to confirm your diagnosis. It's all based on your vaccination history. So no vaccination for tetanus, or very, very far out in the far distance that the horse got vaccinated. Mm. And then the symptoms that you see. So the classical symptoms of a horse with tetanus is, if we see it from the face, prolapse of the third eyelid,
mm-hmm.
The demon's grin, so the demon's grimace, which is the sides of the mouth being pulled up like in a spastic grin.
Mm-hmm.
It's a locked jaw, so if you try to open the mouth, the muscles are completely locked around the jaw. So obviously these horses have a hard time eating.
Mm.
They can't open their mouth. But it's also the stance of the horse. They're completely spastic. When they try to move, they move in like a jerky kind of way because they can't bend their limbs.
Mm.
The tail is erected because it's so spastic. And the sawhorse stance, the one where they cannot move, where they're just completely rigid.
Mm.
And at the end of the day, these horses will lay down and become recumbent in a stiff manner without being able to eat or drink. And most often, the cause of death would be complete paralysis of the respiratory muscles,
mm.
which is a horrible way of dying.
Mm.
So once you start seeing these symptoms, you know that it's probably not going to be a good outcome, and euthanasia should be discussed. Some horses end up at the hospital getting supportive care, especially if the signs are mild, but the horses that end up lying down in recumbency, they will eventually need euthanasia.
Yeah. So you mentioned the clinical symptoms, and how fast does this occur? If you have, for example, the prolapse of the third eyelid, how long can you expect it to take before this horse is completely recumbent?
That depends on how much toxin is produced.
Okay.
And how much it's spread through the central nervous system.
Mm.
But usually it's a progressive disease, so it will become pretty fast that these horses will become very quickly, within a few days.
Mm.
Because that's how fast it takes. And remember, it's an irreversible block of those inhibitory neurons. So it's one of those things that even though that we don't have any medication that can disrupt this blockage of this these receptors.
Mm.
So it's essentially a wait and see if the horse is in a state where that would be okay from an animal welfare perspective.
Mm.
and most often it is not. Having treatment performed when these symptoms are very clear on a horse that's not vaccinated is not a good choice, because they will eventually get down and die from it.
Mm. So this is fortunately not a very common disease, because we, as we discussed in previous episodes, we have a pretty good vaccination rate of the most common or the most dangerous diseases. So I'm guessing as a vet, it's not that often that you encounter these horses in your practice. What can be the typical reason why an owner would call? What would they say? Because I'm expecting then that maybe the owners don't really recognize this as tetanus the first thing they do anyway. So what would an owner say to you on the phone to make you suspect that this is actually a case of tetanus?
There are a few presentations that can be conveyed over a conversation over the phone. One of them that I've heard is that the horse has weird looking eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So the prolapse of the third eyelid would make them think that the horse has an eye infection of some sort.
Yeah.
But most of the cases, it would be because they move in a strange way. So the jerkiness, the stiffness, that gait that they can't move around, and like having a stiff neck and unable to eat. But most of the times it would be that the horse is moving in a strange way.
Yeah.
That would be the primary present. But not being able to eat or drink, sometimes the owner will recognize that. But at that point, it would probably also be moving in a very odd way.
Yeah. So the movement is what the owner will notice at first, or maybe also the eyes.
It would. And if it's very bad, the fact that it cannot get up would also be one. And in that case, if they cannot get up, they're usually completely stiff and lying with stiff legs from one side on their side, having stiff legs. And they would be very sound sensitive as well.
Okay, yeah.
So the fact that they hear something, they would be spooked and jerked. And it's also one of those things that it's a flight animal again, and they feel that they can't move appropriately. So it's a very devastating situation for the horse.
Yeah. What about colic signs or passing feces or anything like that? Is that something that you could first see and think it's due to something else?
It is, but I think if that's the case, then that would be something that's conveyed over the phone, the fact that I don't see any manure from my horse, and that it shows oddness, and that could be misinterpreted as colic over the phone. But when the vet come and see it, there would usually be very solid signs that the horse is a stiff moving horse as well. And in the early process, it would be one of those where, is the horse ataxic or what's going on? So taking a temperature on this horse would be a reasonable thing to do, because you would always suspect that there's some kind of virus problem as well.
Mm.
They would usually not have a high fever, because this is a toxin-induced problem. However, if the horse has been moving around and being agitated, and then the temperature can increase a little bit, but it would rarely go above the 40 unless something else is going on.
Mm.
And that's where a lot of the viruses will be. So one of the differentials would probably be one of the herpes viruses that you would think, is there something ataxic under this?
Mm.
But the herpes horses would not be as spastic in their paresis as these tetanus horses. So the fact that they're stiff and jerky moving, that would be what the third leg prolapse is also not something that we see from the herpes viruses. So
So diagnostics is made entirely through symptoms, or is there any laboratory work or anything else that you can do to 100% rule out anything else?
No, I mean, the only thing would be to have a nasal swab for some of the viruses, of course.
Yeah.
But by the time that you get that back, the diagnosis will be probably very clear to you that this is a stiffness. and not like a ataxia, like a horse with other types of virus diseases.
Mm.
But there's no single test result that can show you that this is tetanus. This is all based on the history and the symptoms that you see on that horse.
Yeah.
One of the big things that needs to be pointed out is that if there is any history related to a wound, for instance, and the time period fits, or if you have had an elective surgery, so for instance, a castration, those wounds can definitely be infected with Clostridium tetani and develop sporulation and production of tetanus spasmin in those wounds. And that in that case, it's very important that the horses are vaccinated.
Yeah.
And making sure that that's not something that they're at risk for when doing that procedure.
You mentioned that there are few options when it comes to treatment. Is there anything I can do for these horses to sort of prevent them from dying?
Yeah. Definitely. So it needs to be one of those things of supportive care again. There's nothing you can do directly in order to treat tetanus.
Mm.
The key is to keep them calm and quiet because it's the strain of them that will cause them to become very distraught. So what I've done in the few that we've been able to manage to save would be to put cotton in their ears and keep them as quiet as possible and just a lot of supportive care with IV fluids, with tube feeding, if that's the case, if they need to have some calories, if they are unable to eat on their own, making sure that their food is in a state that they can, in fact, chew, if that's even possible for the horse. IV infusion of glucose, of all the supportive care that you can give. Some of them can't pass manure, but again, if that's the case, then they're pretty severe affected and the prognosis is probably very poor. But all the supportive care in the world is important. They will try to struggle to get up, so getting injured as well while they lay down and try to get up, that is a concern as well. We have seen broken legs when they do try to get up. So all the protective gear that you can give. These horses, if they should stand a chance, if they are vaccinated and they have mild signs, they're probably better off at a hospital where you can treat them there. But they need to be able to be transported, obviously.
Yeah.
So in some cases, you would try to do it at home. But they take a lot of treatment and supportive care, these horses.
Yeah, I was going to come to that when it comes to hospitalization. I'm imagining that it's not the easiest to transport these horses and that this is probably not ideal.
No.
Is it something that you can take care of at home, so to say?
It depends a little bit. In certain cases, if the cases are mild, I would definitely try and take care of them at home.
Mm.
If they don't need IV fluids, if they are able to drink on their own, if they can chew, etc., then it's certainly something that you should try. But the prognosis, unfortunately, is not great.
What about the antitoxins that are available? Can they do anything for a horse that has already been infected and that has started to develop symptoms?
Yeah. So one thing that has been proposed is that you can bind a circulating, unbound neurotoxin. So you can't do anything about the actual toxin that's bound already because that's irreversibly bound. But if you have still neurotoxin that's present in the body and that's not bound, then that's where you can use the antitoxin as a preventative and kind of stop the development of the disease. It's usually quite high levels of antitoxin that you should administer, and the dose is 100 to 200 units per kilo, and that's given IM daily for between 1 and 10 days. And that way you should at least see that a progression of the disease is not happening. But the already bound toxins or the signs that you're seeing already will not change. Only time will do that, but you will avoid having new toxin bound in the body of the horse if you're lucky. The other thing that you should think about is even if whatever entrance has happened, a wound or anywhere that the Clostridia could have gained access to the body. If it's obvious, then you should definitely look at any signs of anaerobic environment and make sure you debride that wound for any dead tissue, because that it could be the source for continuous production of toxin in that area. So debriding it and making sure that you don't have an anaerobic foci right there would be preventative for further toxin accumulation.
This is not a contagious disease per se. An infected horse won't infect another horse. And you mentioned that they get this usually through a wound or sometimes by ingesting it. How should one think when it comes to wounds? I mean, it's obviously if you're called out on a horse that has a wound that you need to stitch or treat, obviously you will want to know if it's vaccinated for tetanus. But let's say it's not. The wound is 1 day old, so you still have some time. What will be the most important thing to do here when it comes to preventing tetanus in a non-vaccinated horse, for example?
That's a very good question, and it's a very valid one, because that's a situation that poses a risk and you can actually do something about it. So one thing is that you can treat for the bacteria. Clostridia are very sensitive to penicillins. Mm. So penicillin is definitely one of the things that we should choose for this type of bacteria. The other is to prevent the toxin. If it's already started to produce in the wound, you can give an injection of antitoxin to the horse and making sure to vaccinate that horse. So you do both antitoxin and you give tetanus toxoid, the vaccination. Because mm-hmm. the antitoxin will protect the horse from the toxin for a good couple of months. But the vaccination will start getting an antibody level within a couple of weeks. Mm. And then you boost your horse again. And then you have an even higher immune level. And that way you're ahead of the game.
Yeah.
So penicillin, antitoxin, and a vaccination at the same time. And you give the antitoxin and the tetanus toxoid on each side of the neck. So you don't give it in the same region, but you choose the opposite one side and the other side for the other.
Yeah. So. And you mentioned also elective surgery and that this is this can pose a risk for infection. What about surgery? Should I do this procedure also when it comes to, for example, castration, or depending on the horse's vaccination status, I guess?
Yeah. So if you do an elective surgery, the appropriate thing to do as a veterinarian is to make sure that horse is fully protected against tetanus before you even think about putting a scalpel in that.
Yeah.
So if you have something that's elective, that means that you can decide when to perform the procedure. So you can also plan to have this horse protected against tetanus before you start. So I think that's the key here, that you are in control over the sequence of things. So if you do an elective surgery and you end up having a horse with tetanus because you didn't plan appropriately, that would not be good veterinary practice.
Yeah.
So make sure that your horse is protected appropriately before you even think of doing a surgery.
Yeah. So we're talking about vaccination, and there are different vaccines on the market, some of which the vaccination intervals is set to 2 years, others where it's set to 3 years. But I remember when I was in fourth grade, I got the tetanus vaccination. And then as an adult, I got bitten in the hand by a cat when working in small animal practice, and I got another one. That's two in a lifetime. How come that I don't have to get it every 2 or 3 years? And what's the difference here?
Yeah, that's a very good question as well. So we as mammals are very different in our sensitivity towards these toxins. So humans are, in fact, pretty resistant to the toxin. We're not as sensitive, but horses are one of the most sensitive animals when it comes to this toxin. They also live in an environment where we know that they are prone to getting little wounds and getting close to the dirt. They roll around in the dirt. We as humans, we rarely do that. So it's not the same risk. So one thing is that we are not as sensitive, but we are not as much of a risk either. while the horse is both sensitive and at high risk of getting introduction of this Clostridia into their wounds and little cuts and scrapes here and there. So that's two things that are very different from between the species. The horse has been shown that its antibody levels becomes quite high with the vaccination when you use the vaccines in the protocols that's described in the on the manufacturer's SPC. And most of the vaccines, it's every 2 years. Some reports have shown that horses are actually better at keeping their antibody levels for longer than that. But the most safe thing is to follow the SPCs of the various products, because that's where they can kind of guarantee that, and they can give you proof that it's actually protecting within that time frame that they're saying they are. So usually it's around every 2 years of vaccination. However, if you look at the literature, there are other analyses here and there. But the best advice is to just keep following the SPCs on the manufacturer's papers.
So speaking of that, I mean, the tetanus vaccine comes in often together with the influenza vaccine. So you give them both in the same shot, sort of. Why can't I just vaccinate against tetanus every year and use the same vaccination every year? That's very convenient, right?
It is convenient, but it's probably not necessary at all. So we don't want to over vaccinate our horses, and that's why most of the vaccines will give you a regimen where you vaccinate against tetanus only every other year, and that seems to be giving you a good protective status against that. So to avoid over vaccinating, then again follow the SPCs of the various products, because that's what the manufacturers can guarantee the effect of. So
So no point in vaccinating every year. You don't get a better immunity, or it's not more safe.
No. So the way that we evaluate the antibody levels after vaccination is to measure it in the blood. And for these vaccines, you can say for the horse, we assume or the normal level of protection in the blood should be 0.01 international units per mil of blood. And these vaccines, they guarantee a higher level than that after 2 years. So, and even higher, because the minimum measuring level is probably 0.04, so it's well above the protective level even after 2 years. So, but that's the 2 year frame is to be able to guarantee that you have an efficient level of antibody after 2 year, and the risk will then be low for this devastating disease.
You mentioned earlier that also vaccinated horses can develop mild symptoms. Is that something that occurs often, or what's the situation there?
No, not at all. So usually when a horse is vaccinated against tetanus, it's a very, very protective vaccination.
Yeah.
So you have to really look thoroughly into the literature and talk to veterinarians that's been practicing for a long time to find that single one that might have shown some symptoms even though that it was vaccinated. So it's very, very rare, which is great, because again, it's a devastating disease and we have a vaccine that really protects against this deathly disease. So no, you have to really look through the literature to find anything that tells you. And most of the times it's something that's passed on mouth to mouth. So really make sure they're vaccinated.
Yeah. So in this case, we can almost say certainly that if the horse is vaccinated, it's also protected and won't die from this disease. That's a relief. What about the foals? I mean, the vaccination protocols for most of the vaccines, they state that you start with your basis vaccination around 5 months of age. How is the horse or the foal protected before that?
So the foal is born completely naive, so it doesn't have any antibodies in the system. The placenta blocks for any exchange from the mare to the foal. So when the foal is born, as we all know, it's very dependent on getting the colostrum from the mare. So what's in the colostrum? In the colostrum, when the colostrum is produced for the past week or so up until foaling, there is a certain process that's happening in the udder of the mare, where her antibodies that's circulating in the bloodstream gets concentrated like a lot in that process, which is very convenient because that high concentration that's happening during the last week makes sure that the levels are extremely high, and then it can get transferred to the foal by suckling for the first day or so of the foal's lifespan. So that is a golden window for the immunity for the foal. So if you think about it, if the mare was not vaccinated for tetanus, then there would be no antibodies transferred to the foal, and the foal would be extremely high risk for developing tetanus. Mm. And remember that when the foal is born, it has an open umbilicus that ruptures and you get some anaerobic tissues down there. So the foal is actually at high risk for tetanus for the first month of life.
Mm.
So in order to prevent this and making sure that you have a high level of tetanus antibodies in the colostrum, you vaccinate the mare.
Mm.
So the recommendation is to vaccinate the mare 4 to 6 weeks prior to foaling. But before then, the mare should be vaccinated like on a regular, with a regular basis vaccination and booster every year.
Mm.
And then you make sure that booster hopefully will be positioned within the 4 to 6 weeks just prior to foaling. That would be the ideal situation.
Mm.
That way, when she starts producing colostrum, her level of antibodies, as well as whatever else she's vaccinated for, influenza, for instance, will get transferred to the foal when it suckles that golden liquid, which we call colostrum. And the foal will be protected that way up until between 4 and 5 months. And then you can start vaccinating the foal just like the adult horses.
Mm. So what if the foal doesn't get the colostrum for any reason or doesn't get enough? What can I do then?
Yeah, if you have a problem with that, or you're not quite sure whether the mare got vaccinated appropriately, then you have the option of doing the antitoxin. The antitoxin injections will provide your antibodies in the bloodstream of the foal for up to maybe 2 months.
Mm.
And after that, they will start weaning away again. So then the best thing would be to give another dose of antitoxin to the foal. So until the foal can be vaccinated, which is from the earliest age of 4 months with certain type of vaccines, then the antitoxin would be what would be helpful and protective for this foal. And that's extremely important. If you go to a foal and need to address a wound or something where you could see that, okay, here we might have a potential entrance for Clostridia, then really dive deep into the vaccination history of the mare, the colostrum intake, have there been any problems and so forth, and make sure to protect the foal by antitoxin if you're in doubt.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good precaution to take to avoid this devastating disease.
Yes.
Thank you for enlightening us about this rare but terrible disease that can happen to the horses. And yeah, as you said, luckily it's very preventable, and we're very happy for that.
Yeah.
Next episode, we will be talking about a disease that have emerged and become top of mind for at least some vets recently, and that is the West Nile virus. And that I'm looking very much forward to hear more about. So stay tuned for that.
Tak fordi du lyttede med til Hestedyrlande. Hvis du kan lide det, du hører, så læg en anmeldelse i din podcast-app, og glem ikke at fortælle dine kolleger om podcasten. Vi er snart tilbage med et nyt spændende afsnit af Hestedyrlærerne.